One person who's used the N-gram in his work is David Brooks. In his New York Times column, Brooks recently wrote about how the words we've used less and more over the past half century or so show that as a society, we've become more individualistic. Brooks cited a few different N-gram studies showing how words like self and unique have been on the rise while community and share have declined. When you're trying to parse the rise and fall of civilizations, he says, you're looking for one thing.
You're looking for data. And so one of the big cultural shifts you've seen from these N-grams is a shift from community to individualism, a sharp decline over the really decades in use of words having to do with communal attributes, we, group, community, a large number increase in words having to do with individual agency, I intend. And so you get pretty sharp social trends. You don't want to read too much into any small little movement in the trends, but when you see a massive shift over decades, you can be pretty sure that we've moved from a community that's much more communally oriented to a community that says, I'm pretty much captain of my own ship, master of my own fate.
Right. Some of the words that had become less frequent in one of these studies, like fortitude and humbleness, I wondered if simply that was because those words themselves seem antique and old-fashioned, or bravery even. I mean, people may admire bravery, but it seems uncool to talk about it. But maybe that's the point.
Yeah, I'd say that's the point. Fortitude, I give you. That does sound to me like an archaic word. Bravery does not. If you go back to social indicators, and what you're trying to do is link these bits of evidence to broader things you notice in the historical record. And so, for example, if you go back to Princeton in the 1920s, they had a theory of how to create men of character, and then it was an all-male school. And what they did was they took rich young boys, mostly from old blue blood families, and they toughened them up. They would have this institution called a snowball fight between the freshman and sophomore class each winter, which was really a rock fight. This was part of an effort to toughen people up and to instill courage in them, which was seen as the primary of the virtues. So I do think it matches the historical record that we're less courage-oriented and we're probably more into the cooperative virtues.
Now, with these kind of big data analyses, I mean, one begins with hypotheses. You know, you have a set of beliefs about America and how we are or aren't going to hell, and presumably these academics do as well. Is that sort of a problem with such things, is that you can pick your cherries and now you have the big data ability to pick your cherries?
That is true. But I think what we do is there are some things data can do for us, some things observations can do for us. And you're looking to test one versus the other. And so I think if we look at cultural trends, a lot of what we're inevitably and properly going to rely on is our sensations as we go about our lives, mm-hmm. as we look at books, as we feel things. But you do have to be prepared for surprises. So one of the surprises I found in other work I've done is I thought people who used the word I a lot were more likely to be prideful and narcissistic than people who didn't, who were more self-forgetting or self-effacing. That turns out to be the opposite of the truth. People who are completely egomaniacal and narcissistic are so confident of themselves, they actually don't use the word I a lot. They actually use the word I less. So you do have to test your intuitions against data and one against the other.
There are many people in the humanities who are objecting to this encroachment into their world of close reading and close looking by data. Is that just what academics always do? And should they welcome this as another tool in looking at how culture and art and literature can be examined?
Yeah, I think one of the key things we have to accomplish over the next couple of years is find the limits of both data, of scientism, of economic modeling. In other words, we used to understand ourselves through the prism of the humanities, through the prism of theology, and we would say these are the soft, less data-driven, less mathematical ways of understanding ourselves. Over the last 20 years, we've had many more mathematical ways of understanding ourselves or scientific ways. And it seems to me we have to understand what those things can be used for and what they can't. Data is really good at probability. One of the things our normal intuitions are really bad at math. And so we're really bad at predicting probabilities. Mm-hmm. And so using data for that strikes me as very good. One of the things our normal intuitive mind is really good at, first of all, pattern recognition. Second of all, is evaluating other people. And so understanding what data can do and what it can't do seems to me the primary job of the next couple of years. My problem with the humanities is that they've become a little too insecure about threats from what the neurosciences might do to them, as if they're going to replace the humanities. And believe me, understanding the synapses will never help us explain the creation of Macbeth or Othello. And to me, the humanities are in decline because they've lost their core mission. They've spent too much time talking about race, class, and gender, too much time talking about social repair, not enough time talking about internal improvement, internal redemption. And if they're going to abandon their core mission, then the humanities will continue to decline.
Well said. David Brooks, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times.